This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Marriage and the single black woman. Throughout history, single black women have been cast in a dim light, from slavery when they were unable to marry legally to the Reagan era that painted a picture of welfare queens. But what if the stereotypes are wrong? Joining us to talk about her research on marriage and single black women is Andrea Williams. She's an English professor at The Ohio State University. She's in the Triangle as a fellow at the National Humanities Center, doing research on unmarried women in the early 20th century. Andrea Williams, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Tell us more about this, about the perception that we've had, particularly about single black women through history.
One of the things that I find is that single black women have often been the symbol to think about American civic alienation. And you rightly point to two time periods and two symbols that point that out for us, that some scholars have referred to the kind of unmarried black woman under slavery as a definitive spinster, because even if she was socially coupled and partnered, she couldn't be legally married. Of course, abolitionists used that image to be able to decry the way that slavery was breaking down families. And so in that way, we can see the way that her image as a single black woman was used in a political way towards progressive politics. The other side of that has been then more recently, in which the single African American woman is more often represented as a sense of how far African Americans seem not to have come, both since emancipation and since the civil rights movement of the mid to late 20th century. And so what my work really wants to do is to think about what have been the other both lived experiences and literary and cultural representations of black women. I was really drawn to the kind of research that I do because I was both seeing headlines with things that say, is the black church keeping black women single? Or a recent book like, is marriage for white people? At the same time that I was teaching 19th century American and African American literature and thinking about some of the discussions of marriage and singleness going on there. So part of what I've been interested in is what have been the cultural narratives about marriage and singleness, and particularly about single black women over the last 100 years or so, even though I focus more specifically in the early 20th century.
Well, let's talk about the broader narrative. I mean, this makes the most sense in the larger context of how we have understood as Americans, perhaps Westerners, this whole concept of marriage, what it means not to be married, and what it has meant for all women to women in particular, black and white, not to be married.
Yes. Now there are about half of Americans who are unmarried, and I think that that is raising some ire and some concern. I think historically for African American women, one thing that marriage meant, particularly after slavery, because so many enslaved black women couldn't be married, is that marriage was associated with freedom. It meant that in that period after slavery, one actually had possession of your own body well enough to say, I do, because before that, a master could say, actually, no, you don't, because I'm selling you downriver. But marriage then in that kind of post-emancipation time could actually mean a form of contractual agreement that black women were able to enter. There have been other studies, however, too, to say that marriage could also be a form of coercion, especially around labor organization when plantation owners became landowners who wanted to keep black nuclear families on those plantations as free workers and said only mother, father, and children can stay here and not single women, which is why single women often ended up in the city. So we do see African Americans often representing marriage as freedom, and yet there is the risk of there being the implicit opposite of that argument of suggesting, okay, well, what then does singleness mean for unfreedom, or does it mean a lack of progress, and how that can be a very thorny interpretation.
Has it changed over time? I mean, have single women always been seen as sort of something not right? There's something we need to fix about that, or has that, and is it different for different women, black and white, at different time periods?
It is different for different women, black and white, over time period. But I'll give you one example, again, starting from the 19th century, which is part of my background. as I was thinking about the role of single women over time, there was a kind of cultural concept in the 19th century, mid to late 19th century, of single blessedness. The idea that there actually was something blessed and something good in remaining single, and that single women had contributions to make to their society and to their families. So, for instance, if a mother was having a baby, it was often a single aunt who was able to provide some care for the family. So single women actually had a very important and integral role to sustaining even nuclear heteronormative families. I think, though, that that impression of single women's role has been different for Black and white women, again, presenting Black single women as being a problem that could deter the progress of African Americans, that could mean greater numbers of children born outside of wedlock. I particularly think about Theodore Roosevelt, who was concerned with white women having more children, lest there be race suicide. We know that this was connected to kind of white supremacist understandings of the nation, of wanting to have more white babies that outnumbered immigrants and African Americans, so that there was less national concern about Black women remaining single than it was for white women.
So you talk about the turn of the century, Teddy Roosevelt issuing a warning that white women need to get out there and get married first and then have their babies or commit, as you say, in his words, right, race suicide. And then you fast forward to the pathologizing of single white, single Black mothers in particular, Ronald Reagan raising the specter of the welfare queen, a highly racialized view that he used to become elected. Right.
Right. And in fact, I think that this attitude of thinking about single Black women as mothers has become so prominent that even single women without children right. are often assumed to have children, that one may immediately ask an African-American single woman, so do you have children, without asking about her marital status. What this has led me to do in my work, then, is to, in some ways, disaggregate motherhood from singleness, to think about what we can learn about the status of singleness alone. One of the things that I argue is that singleness actually is an embodied state. And what I mean by that is, I'll give you an example. Walking into a room, a friend told me that when she was single, she walked into a room and she immediately looked at a ring finger of men to think, okay, is there a partner here? Or was very self-conscious about, what will people think as I walk into this room alone? Will they think that I'm desperate? Will they think that I'm lonely? So I think that we could take this even further in thinking about the ways that everything from how people see the world to think and feel and move through space and time can be informed by their marital status. This has implications for everything from the ways that we think of housing development, especially in a city like Durham. Is the city building more single-family homes with his and her matching sinks, which assume that there will be a couple there, than they are providing for the lives of single people?
So you can see how this is institutional, how it affects you personally, subjectively, if you're in this situation, if you are a single woman. And then there's the question of our perceptions as well. And you talked about one just a minute ago, the perception that particularly single Black women might be holding back progress. I mean, what you found quite the contrary, that when this is a decision, this can actually contribute greatly to the cause.
Right. One of the things that I've been looking at is to think about Black professional women in the early 20th century in particular, who often were the first to integrate their professions, the first Black woman who's a doctor in this area, the first teacher here, the first dentist here. And Durham and North Carolina has its own kind of stories around that. For example, with the Delaney sisters, Bessie and Sadie Delaney, who came to somewhat national fame in the 1990s near the end of their lives because they lived to be over 100 years old. And they often said that they lived so long and had good health because they didn't have husbands and men to bother them and to worry them to death. And their progress in terms of being, one was a teacher and one was a dentist, was very much because they were able to mobilize and to move from one location to another and spend a good bit of their time in education. Actually, Bessie, the younger of the two sisters, said that before she went to dental school, her mother, who lived here in Raleigh, their family was from Raleigh, and her father was an Episcopal priest out at St. Aug University. And her mother sat her down and said, okay, you need to think seriously about marriage or career. And as Bessie was later thinking, she said, you know, at the time, this is 19-teens and 20s, no one gave me the opportunity to really think about how I might merge those two. But she did determine that career seemed to have the better long-term trajectory for her. And so we repeatedly see that African-American single women were often on the forefront of moves in education, as healthcare reformers, as 4-H demonstrators who were driving around and teaching other people about homemaking, even as they themselves may or may not have had homes that they owned.
This suggestion, though, this distinction or choice that you might have between career and family does suggest a class distinction, right?
Right. And so it is the case that singleness is partly a privilege for many of the women that we look at earlier in the 20th century, that they were able to live without being dependent on a second income, or that they were able to find innovative ways to build coalition with other single women. So again, in the case of the Delaneys, they lived most of their lives together, purchasing a home together, buying products. More contemporarily, we might think about two single women going in together on a Costco membership, right? It takes a long time to use up all those 48 rolls of toilet paper. But if you can spread them across two households of single dwellers, you have more innovative strategies for how people are thinking about how to live out their single lives.
And then talking about the need, too, the economic need in many ways for single women in particular. And you talked about, again, coming back to Durham, North Carolina Mutual making an accommodation here.
Right. So North Carolina has a very rich history of ways that it has tried to accommodate the lives of single Black women. North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, one of the major employers and Black-owned companies here in the earlier 20th century, actually noticed that both because it was usually the case that single women lived with their families, that if the company wanted to hire more single Black women, it needed to make accommodations for them. And so at some point in the 20s, the company set up living quarters for its single women, which was both an accommodation for them in terms of privacy or gender and the kind of vulnerability that they might have felt in the city. And it also was a response to racial segregation that very much then divided the city up into its different quadrants.
You said that North Carolina is an interesting place for you to come and do research for a lot of reasons, right?
Yes. The Delaneys themselves from Raleigh had roots here, as did Anna Julia Cooper, a woman who was married briefly before being widowed and lived to be 107, 110 or so, living out most of those years as a single woman and being the first African-American woman to earn a PhD from the Sorbonne in France. So she really was able to mobilize on that, later adopted 4 or 5 children. So we really do see the contributions that single Black women make, often having some connection here. I'll share another story of Charlotte Hawkins Brown, again, a native of Henderson, North Carolina, who was educated in Boston and then came back to the state in 1901 to start Palmer Memorial Institute in Sedalia, North Carolina, which grew over a 70-year period or so to be a kind of premier private school for African American students. And that was especially an important contribution in the earlier period when Black public education was spare and was not meeting the same kinds of standards as white education at the time. So we repeatedly see women who either after the end of a divorce or being widowed or having been never married use that as an opportunity to really mobilize their careers and make long-standing contributions to Black communities as activists, reformers, and so on.
And places like Bennett College are also great places for research, right?
Right. Bennett College, as one of the two remaining Black Women's Colleges also has archives where I'm able to look, for example, at women who remained in that environment as dorm mothers. Again, a seeming paradox of teaching everyone else how to be a mother as you remain in a kind of public living space. But I actually think that those spaces then give us some innovative strategies of how single women were starting to have different relationships with space, with what you call home, with how to organize your meals as a single person. And we get the kind of follow-up of that now, even with contemporary culture, with cookbooks like Cooking for One Using a Microwave. So they really were using these single-sex spaces of boarding houses, lodging houses, dormitories to rethink if single women live long-term unmarried, how can they set up their lives, both for personal satisfaction and for community contribution.
You focused on the late 19th, early 20th century, but we're seeing this play out more and more in pop culture, both in general, in terms of general trends toward marriage, less and less of it, but also Hollywood images. I mean, Shonda Rhimes is someone who's been very deliberate about her single and the roles she's played, right?
Right. I think both in Shonda Rhimes' productions and in her very public conversation with Oprah Winfrey about why both of those women determined not to marry, we start to see the kinds of options that are available, especially based on one's class or professionalization in a way there. And I do think that it's important to have those kinds of stories because more often it's the case, and feminist scholars have noted this before, more often it's the case that stories about single women end in one of two ways, either marriage or death. And so to be able to give storylines that are serial in these kinds of series like How to Get Away with Murder or Scandal, we actually see those characters cycling in and out of relationships, but remaining apart from the institution of marriage for the ways that that gives them different kinds of freedom and especially allows for them to model their leadership of the organizations that they lead.
Is the impression of Black single women softening in light of the fact that marriage itself is not, you know, the statistics about millennials, I think only 26% are married or something like this. So the idea that the institution itself has more or less fallen on hard times, has that made a difference for our perceptions on Black women?
I think to some extent that it has. I think that in some ways, the public culture is catching up with what had already been the kinds of trends among more single women, more African-American women remaining single, so that we can start to have some of those different images. But I'll continue to say that a move continues to need to be made in thinking about what this means for our political culture and our social culture. So long as there is any level of stigma that continues to follow single women to say, well, yes, you have this PhD, or yes, you are the CEO, but where are your children and babies? That there is a double standard that doesn't best serve the interest of the kind of brain power that we have coming from both married and single women. I think, again, we shouldn't have to have the kinds of discussions that one of the Delaney sisters had to have with her mother. That was 1910 and 20, and I'm hoping that now that both Americans who are single and married will have more opportunity to think about the lifestyles that suit them.
Andrea Williams is an English professor at The Ohio State University, the author of Dividing Lines, Class Anxiety and Postbellum Black Fiction, and she's currently a fellow at the National Humanities Center doing research on single African-American women in the early 20th century. Andrea, what a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
You can find out more about her work at our website, stateofthings.org. And on Thursday, April 12th, she'll be giving a talk about her research at the National Humanities Center in Research Triangle Park. That's at 6 o'clock, and she'll be alongside scholar Tara Hunter. And we have that information, again, at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, he went from the NFL to orbiting space for NASA. Astronaut Leland Melvin joins us to talk about second chances and his passion for STEM, STEAM, and his book, Chasing Space. Stay tuned.